So having had that talk, now, are there any questions or comments or complaints? Is anyone going to ask the first question on the talk this evening?
Please come forward and pick up the microphone.
As we're waiting for the first question, to encourage questions, I usually teach the following story, which is from the Buddhist Sutras. And this particular story is, to encourage questions, one moment, sir. The Buddha taught about the law of reincarnation and also the law of karma. Someone once asked him, why is it that some people are born into wealthy families while other people are born into poverty? He also said, why is it that some people are born beautiful while other people are born ugly? And you should notice when I mentioned the word ugly, I looked at the floor. Because once in Singapore, I mentioned this, and I said ugly, and I was looking at a particular woman. And she complained, why did you say ugly when you were looking at me? So now I always look at the floor. But in particular, what is the karmic cause? Why are some people born intelligent? You know, some people, they just breeze through university. And other people have to work so hard. Why? What's the karmic cause for intelligence in your next life? What's the karmic cause for stupidity? And in the Mahakamavibhanga Sutta, the Buddha said, the karmic cause for stupidity in your next life is not asking questions in this life. Any questions? Okay, sir, so you're going to be the first intelligent one in the next life.
Hello, hello.
Yes, yeah, go on.
I'm destined not to ask this question. Tony hadn't just recently converted to Catholicism and being welcomed by the Pope at the Vatican. And if he hadn't sold himself to one of the big American banks for $1 million a year, what would you have him do to help solve global warming as a leading international politician? What should they be doing? Should they be, for example, regulating against size of houses, or what should they do?
Okay, what could a person like Tony Blair sort of do to regulate against global warming? Sometimes regulations are not kept. So obviously the idea of winning hearts and minds in Iraq was not done. The idea of winning hearts and minds for global warming has to be obviously the first priority. Grassroots up rather than government down, I think, should always be the way in such things. And I think it's just the cultural change is necessary. A change away from rewarding consumers, in other words, rewarding wealth, promoting wealth, celebrating power, to celebrating other things such as cooperation, harmony. The Bhutanese government, as you may know, they were the ones who started promoting the idea of not gross national product, but gross national happiness as a benchmark for success in life. And measuring their government's success, not by the increase in the economy, but in the increase of the social factors such as lesser divorces, less suicides, greater social cohesion. So one thing a person like Tony Blair could do was to use his experience and influence is actually to change the way we measure the success of a society. And that's one thing we can do, which Bhutanese government started, but I don't know how many people pick it up, to actually say, well, what's the economy is obviously important, but it's important if it creates happiness for people and sort of social cohesion. And so if we go to what the economy is really there for, not the economy as the be-all and end-all of life, then I think Tony Blair can maybe make a contribution. So I think it's actually changing the parameters by which we measure the success of a government. Did you agree with that, or do you want to comment back? Okay. Next question, please. Come on, you need more intelligent people in the next rebirth. Yes. Okay. Okay, you're talking about nuclear power stations. How can we protest against things like nuclear power stations or anything else which is like wrong in society or bad in society? How do we make an effective protest? I know it might be political, but when I was in Australia just during October, we had the Burmese monks walking silently with cool hearts, chanting the Metta Sutta day after day after day after day, which got world headlines. And I'm not quite sure what the reaction was in Bangkok, because in Bangkok it's culturally inappropriate for monks to protest. But certainly in the Western countries, many people told me they were encouraged, inspired and applauded the actions of those monks. In particular, because it was a cool protest. No slogans were chanted, no angry words were said. They were never saying to denounce the junta in Burma. It was a peaceful protest. And it was that peace which gave that protest the power to hit the headlines of the news channels and newspapers throughout the world. People underestimate the power of peace. It immediately takes the high moral ground and makes it very difficult for any other power to argue with you. As soon as you get angry and upset and you lose your cool heart, you lose your moral authority, and it's very easy for your opponent to destroy you. Apparently, from what I was told by Burmese students in Australia, it was the introduction of the student movements into those protests which made the Burmese military intervene. If they'd have kept out and left it to the monks, there would have been a different outcome. It was the student groups turned it into a political demonstration rather than an incredibly unique, peaceful march. I always remember the words of Gandhi. And Gandhi, this little guy, kicked out the British from India. Just almost one man destroyed the hold of an incredibly powerful imperial power over that country. And I remember one of his sayings, which I always keep in mind, and it's a wonderful Buddhist saying: I can see 1,000 reasons to give my life for a good cause. I can't see one reason to take the life of another. I can see 1,000 reasons to give my life, but not one reason to take a life. And that made that man an inspiration and an effective political catalyst. So, if you want to protest, protest peacefully, determinedly, without giving up. People who give up are the ones who lose. And it's amazing what power you can generate. Peaceful power is far greater than nuclear power. There was a question in the back over there. Yeah. It's not working again. Okay, we've got a spare mic on here. Yeah? No? Well, can you project your voice to do this without using electricity and thereby being a good example of using nature rather than other power sources? Don't know what it is. It must be something to do with the monk power, that all these things stop working.
Hello. Yeah. You mentioned in the beginning that we should focus on today, and we should try to do the best for today. But you know, later on you you said that you know we should happy about the way we are and try to you know not to focus on making money and try to relax a little bit. So how do you balance between the two?
So I couldn't get the end of the question.
How do you find a balance between trying to focus to do the best for today and but not to be so greedy about making money and all the stuff?
Okay, it's in the present moment. It's the only time you can work. So this is the time you have to put in the effort, not tomorrow. And you have to know what's a very good goal in life. What are you focusing on? You're a young man. What do you want to achieve in life? And when you actually look for what you want to achieve, what is the goal? What do you want to see happen in this town, in this country, in this world? And set really beautiful goals. Idealism, I think, should be promoted more. Sometimes people have got so jaded, they've lost their idealism and they're just getting by. And I've always been an idealist. And I found that idealism is a wonderful power. It inspires, encourages, gives a huge amounts of energy, and can mobilize amazing forces. So keep your idealism and don't lose it because of the cynicism of other people. And see if you can do something really worthwhile in your life. Know how you can actually help yourself and other people. Sometimes that. Actually, this was something which happened to me years ago. What happened to me, what I decided to be my goal in life, was actually very early on when I went to visit England for the first time. I think I was 8 years as a monk. And I went to visit England for the first time. And Ajahn Sumedho, many of you know, decided he was going to try his best to keep me there. Eventually, Ajahn Chah said, no, I've got to go back. He had other plans for me. But I remember one thing we did was to visit Scotland, and he took me on this retreat in Oban, and I was just his attendant. And I was getting pretty bored because as an attendant you've got to listen to all these people coming in, sort of asking their meditation questions, and they're all the same. I was getting pretty bored and sleepy, but then this one woman came in. And her first words were to this Ajahn Sumedho, Lungpo Sumedho, Chakun Sumedho Ajahn, I want to thank you for saving my life. And she said it with such sincerity, I woke up and wanted to listen, what do you mean saving my life? What's this monk done? He's not like a heart surgeon or a doctor. What's he done to save your life? And then she told the story that she was a student when she had a slight depression. And in those days, the doctors at university was prescribed Valium, an antidepressant. And this lady had become addicted to Valium. And she'd gone on this retreat, and she'd heard on Buddhist retreats you have to maintain 8 precepts. One of those precepts, number 5, was not taking alcohol or drugs. And she misunderstood. She thought that meant her Valium as well, but really it means non-prescription drugs. So for 9 days, she stopped taking her pills. Now the town of Oban is a fishing village on the west coast of Scotland, one of the most peaceful places you can imagine in the world. And this was a retreat where everyone was so kind, and she was learning with mindfulness just how to watch her feelings. So for 9 days it was not that difficult to stop taking her pills. But then she decided, I've done 9 days, let's see if I can carry on without the Valium. And her problem was, to get back home she had to go from Oban to Glasgow, to the station, which is like Hua Lumpong, it's a crazy place. And so she told Ajahn Sumedho she almost lost it completely at that station, but managed to force herself to get back home, where she spent the next 2 months mostly sitting in a chair, waiting for the effects of that drug to go out of her system. And what she heard on that retreat, the teachings of meditation and positive attitude, got her through that time. And she described, I remember exactly what she said, For years I was living like in a fog. I couldn't really feel. I could hear, but, you know, 20% clarity. Now I am free. I'm alive again. Thank you for saving my life. And when I heard that, I always remembered that. And at that time I made a resolution. If during my whole life as a monk, if one person, only one person comes up to me and say, thank you for saving my life, then my whole monk life would be worthwhile. That's all I wanted. That's my goal, just one person. And of course, many people have actually come up and said that to me, so I'm way ahead of my goal. What an inspiring goal that is. It's not to be wealthy. It's actually to get the most wonderful joy of all is actually serving others. You're giving to somebody else. That doesn't cost anything. And that's what you can do now. So as a young man, be idealistic. Now work your butt off to serve and help other people. And also serve and help yourself to be peaceful and enable yourself to be kind to others. Has anyone got any comments or questions? Yeah, up here.
Hello. As you mentioned earlier, just now, that what we should do is to you know, we're born and exist to help others and to think of the greater good. And in the family, and with your loved ones, when they have higher, they have different expectations of you, and they want you to do the family business and to succeed in a more material way, how would you suggest the person to answer or to pacify them, to make them happy so you can go do what you feel is right?
Okay, the following story applies to that situation about a family life and wanting to be materially comfortable. And it's usually the pressure is on the man to provide that for the family. But this story is a classic story. This man came home from work, and his six-year-old son was waiting for him. And the six-year-old son said to his father, as soon as his father came through the door, Daddy, how much do you earn at work every hour? Daddy said, shut up, son, I'm tired, nothing to do with you. Son said, Daddy, how many dollars do you earn every hour at work? Look, I've told you, be quiet, I'm tired. Daddy, how much do you earn? Look, I've told you three times, up to your room. Because the daddy was tired. And what does a six-year-old need to know about how much you earn at work? How can he appreciate what even $20 is? But after the father relaxed, because, you know, you do get tired, you know, rushing through the traffic to get back home, you had a busy day, sometimes you are grumpy, but once you relax, the father felt so guilty, he shouted at his son. So he went up the stairs and knocked on his child's door and asked to come in, and said to his son, look, I'm sorry I shouted at you like that. I shouldn't have done that. I was tired, had a very tough day at work. And look, I don't know why you want to know this, but I earn $20 an hour at my work, okay? And his son smiled at the daddy, and daddy smiled back. And the son opened his mouth and said, well, Daddy, can I borrow $10 then, please? And daddy was about to shout at him again, but he'd already shouted at him once. So daddy gritted his teeth, opened his wallet, and gave his six-year-old son a $10 note. And the son smiled a second time, and reached under his pillow in his bedroom, and took out another $10 in coins and notes, counted out 20, and gave it to his father, and said, Daddy, here's $20. Now can I please have 1 hour of your time? And that's a wonderful story. The child having to buy his father's time. I remember, because I go to Singapore a lot, and Singapore is not that different from Bangkok. The culture is pretty much the same. 3 years ago, I think it was a 17-year-old boy was found at the foot of the apartment block. He jumped off and committed suicide. His suicide note, which was in the front page of the Straits Times, was, "All I wanted was to spend more time with my mummy and daddy." That's a true story. Sometimes we work very hard, but we're doing that for our children. We ask the children what they want. Sometimes what the children want is mummy and daddy and time with them. And if you run a company, or if you're in management, I told this to the nation yesterday morning, and I also told this at a business conference in London where I taught out last April. A company called Farrelly and Sons, who I think their offices are in Birmingham, they're an engineering firm which does building maintenance. They won an industry award for their business practice. This particular innovation trebled their turnover and doubled their profits within 12 months. There's a very simple innovation. What this company, Farrelly and Sons, did was to ban overtime. At the end of the day, everybody had to get out and they could not take work home with them. They worked a certain number of hours and that was it. They were completely forbidden from any overtime. Once that was instituted, turnover increased, trebled, and their profits doubled. And their staff turnover went to zero. No one wanted to leave. Can you understand the psychology of that? You all know that if you work too long at work, you get stressed out, you have family problems. And when you have your family problems, it means you can't rest at night. When you go to work in the morning, you take the family problems to work and you get into this cycle of worry, stress, which means you cannot work efficiently. So by lessening the time these people spent in their office, that time was far more efficiently used. This is a message I told these business leaders from Intel, PricewaterhouseCoopers, British Airways. It was such an effective message, I got invited back to speak at the annual general conference of the British National Health Service, which I didn't go because it was during the rains of free time. Now the NHS wanted me to tell them how to run their business. It's simple stuff. You've got to care for your workers. They're the most valuable resource. And be efficient. If you work long hours, you're just not efficient anymore. And you get the problems. You're not with your family. Which means that you take that problem back to work. How can you be efficient when you're worrying about your wife divorcing you, your kids getting into trouble, and you realize you're not spending much time with them? So it's basic work efficiency, basic psychology. If you rest at night, when you go to work, you become far more productive. So in the 8, 9 hours or 10 hours you spend at work, you get heaps done. Much more than if you spend 15 hours at work tired. So it's not just the amount of work, it's a quality. And that quality which you do at work is enhanced by the quality time you spend with your family. And this Farrelly and Sons, brilliant managers there, they realize if we let our workers spend more time with their wife, their husband, their children, when they come to work the next day, they're going to be far more productive. And it trebled. Turnover trebled, profits doubled. It's a classic example of good business practice. And if your business makes you work too hard, that's a business model which is old style. They should keep up with the times and be kind and get more work out of their employees. So, I don't know, did that answer your question? Sort of? Okay. Next question, yes.
In fact, life is uncertainty. Could you please suggest how to teach your children about life is uncertainty?
How to teach your child that life is uncertain. I learned that life is uncertain as a child. Did I tell that story last night about going to the dentist? No, okay. I must have been about 7 or 8 years of age. No, I think a bit old, about 9 or 10, because I was late primary school. And I had a dentist appointment the next day. And I hated going to the dentist. So I asked my mummy, "Mummy, don't send me to the dentist." She said, "You have to go, son. I don't like going to the dentist. You must go." So I tried, even as a child, you're very good at emotional pressure. I said, "Mummy, you don't love me." She said, "I do love you. You've got to go to the dentist." "No, you don't. You won't send me there." So at night time, I didn't sleep well that night. And in the morning, I tried again, one last chance. "Mummy, don't send me. Please don't send me dentist. I don't want to go dentist." But she took me there herself. And when we got to the dentist surgery, only then did I find my appointment was cancelled. All that worry for nothing. And I learned then that life is uncertain. So I don't think you need to teach your children all that much. Because they should see that make a plan and see how much it goes wrong. And so that is our life. So we cannot predict very much at all. Yes, great, from Sister Sundra.
I would like you to speak a little bit more about the previous question, because over the years I have come across situation where I felt the children, or let's say the young people that talk to me or story I heard, there's a kind of pressure for them family to continue the family kind of business or the family business, and I think the question that this young man was asking is a very important one for many young people these days, especially, you know, whether in Thailand or any other places, but in Thailand I've come across that more often. And I'd like you to speak a little bit more about how to skillfully, for a young person, to skillfully really recognize what they want to do rather than their parents want to do for them. I feel this is quite an important situation for young people today.
It is very important, because a lot of pressure is put on young people at the most sensitive time of their lives. It's usually when they're going through their adolescent period. It's hard enough for young people just to compete in the marketplace for boyfriends and girlfriends, and all the pressure on that. That's hard enough. And then you sort of try and get them to do something good in life. I never followed my father's profession. But be careful of the pressure you put on your children, especially that starts at school. And I told this to parents in Singapore. If your child comes in the top 5% or the bottom 5% at school or university, that they're not good Buddhists. If they're in the top 5% or bottom 5%, they're not good Buddhists. Because as Buddhists, we believe in the middle way. So if your child is in the middle there somewhere, well, you're a good Buddhist. So please don't put pressure on kids. The only job to do is to encourage them, because obviously too much pressure just stuffs them up. And they try so hard to fulfill their parents' wishes. And especially if their wishes are concrete wishes, like, you know, want to carry on the business or be successful, pass the exams. If those parents express those sorts of wishes, they cause a huge amount of pressure which again, many kids actually do commit suicide or do take a wrong way simply because they cannot live up to their parents' perceived expectations. So wise parents say, look, what I really want, wish for you, what I want you to achieve is happiness. I don't care how you are happy in this life. As long as actually you are happy and at peace with yourself, then that's all I really want. And of course, many of you know who read my book, that's what I got from my father. My father's expectations for me were expressed in what he said, son, whatever you do in your life, the door of my heart will always be open to you. And that was incredibly powerful for me. And I wasn't a high achiever at that age. I started doing really well later on at school. So when I'd never had to do anything great to live up to my father's expectations, that's probably one of the reasons I went to Cambridge. He freed me. And if you free a child, of course, then only then can they live up to their potential and they can find their place in life, whatever that place happens to be. So the job of a parent, really, there should be to do something like that to them, to say to their child, daughter, their son, look, whatever you do in life, I'm your mum, I'm your dad, and I'll always love you and encourage you. The door of my heart's always open to you, no matter what you turn out as. And then you're giving your child the absolute best encouragement to succeed in whatever way they find they need to succeed. Again, the other piece of advice that many of you, I hope, have seen, that wonderful graduation address at Stanford University by Steve Jobs. It's a great piece of advice, actually, if you get it down from the internet and give it to your children. Because everyone here, I hope, would know that Steve Jobs was the founder of Apple Computers, the first popular PC, personal computer. He was a founder in his garage, built up this multi-million dollar company. And when, I think it was IBM got into the PC market, sort of the first challenge to Apple, they didn't respond very well, their share price went down, and the board needed to sacrifice someone. And they chose Steve Jobs. He was sacked from the company he founded. About 28 or something, he was out of a job on the scrap heap. He was depressed for about 3 or 4 days. And then he started thinking, what do I like doing in life? And again, computing. So he went back to his garage, probably a much bigger garage by now. And he founded 2 new companies. One of them was called Excel, E-X-C-E-L, which became a multi-million dollar company, and was taken over by Apple Macintosh. So he was back on the board, back in the company again. And the second company he founded, after he got sacked, was even more well known. Pixel. Pixel, the company behind Toy Story and quite another few other movies. This is what, he'd already founded one multi-million dollar company, Apple Macintosh. He got sacked, he founded 2 more. That's a guy who just cannot be stopped. And he said at his graduation address to these young people from Stanford University, stay hungry and stay passionate. In other words, do whatever it is in your life you really feel you love and you really want to do. You really get a lot of enjoyment out of. It doesn't matter if you're going to make money out of it or not, because you will be successful if you've got a passion for it. And stay hungry. The best thing was getting thrown out of his job so he wasn't comfortable. It stimulated him to find 2 more companies. So I am passionate about being a monk. I love it. So that's why I have a lot of fun being a monk. And that's why I'm good at it. Because if you're passionate about it, you really love doing it, it doesn't matter what you are in life, you really be a good one. whatever it is. And you'll be happy doing it, and you'll really be very powerful whatever you do. And also stay hungry. In other words, don't just sit back and rest on your laurels. That's why I always try putting myself in different situations. Last few days, when I was in Singapore, I was performing in a concert, in a musical. I see the nun's eyes rise. The musical was called Passage of Time. It was performed by my group, Buddhist Fellowship, to packed houses over 4 or 5 nights. The Minister of Health came the last night. When I say performing, I was performing as myself, so I wasn't singing and dancing. But sometimes I like to do things in a different way, to innovate. As Steve Jobs says, to stay hungry and to see what happens. And it was based on the stories from Open the Door of Your Heart. One of the songs was called Open the Door of Your Heart. Another one, This Too Will Pass, which was actually composed by a disciple just after she lost her father. Her father died. I saw him just before he died. And afterwards, she decided for her father to write this song based on This Too Will Pass. And later on, she wrote another song about falling leaves, based on the story in the book that when a storm goes through a forest, it doesn't just take the old leaves, it takes the young leaves as well, to solve the problem of a young child dying. And even Truckload of Dung got a song at the end. And so it was like learning, it was a show, a concert, which was tracing a lady's life in the old days in Malaysia, Singapore, an arranged marriage, which went wrong. The husband started messing around with other women. She got really upset and so angry, without forgiveness, was killing her. And eventually these stories helped her. And the end part of the concert was when this fictional lady's daughter, who went over to England, to study, and would not come back for her father's funeral because she was disgusted at his behavior with other women. But then, and according to this concert, this musical, she read a book, Open the Door of Your Heart, and changed her life. And then she said, would you like to meet the author, Ajahn Brahm? And that's when I come on stage. And I tell a couple of stories. So I'm playing myself. It's a great way of actually spreading the Dhamma. So people actually see, like, teachings of the Buddha enacted in a play, which relates to your real life. Because I don't know how many women here have had husbands who've had mistresses, me and Noi. It hurts. I don't know how many people will not forgive. And that hurts even more. And when you learn how to let go, of the grief when a loved one dies or a child dies, maybe your daughter or son, that really hurts. And if you can give a teaching, even by music and concert, which heals that pain, which it does. The lead in that play, the one playing the old woman who'd been hurt, she's a Catholic. And she played this because just before her mother died, someone gave her a copy of Open the Door of Your Heart. And that meant so much to her, got her through her mother's death and afterwards, that she decided to play this for the Buddhists as a gift to her mother, out of respect to her mother. And also for me as well. So that's why staying hungry means innovating, maybe doing things in a slightly different way, seeing how it works. So that's what I was up to a few days ago. And it was mostly young people who were in the audience, and young people acting. Because they get into that, they like singing and dancing. I didn't dance because I can't. And if I sang, people would walk out. Okay, any other questions?
Yes. Yeah. Ajahn Brahm, thank you very much for this wonderful evening, sharing your wisdom and your very nice stories with us. And before you go, I just ask one question, and maybe it's also my story. I was born in this small place close to Tibet, and I see a lot of Tibetan monks, and then when I get out from my village, and I don't see any monks, except I go to the temple, or I don't see any of the religion. Yes, okay. But now I'm growing up, and I went to a lot of places and come to Thailand. It's 80% of people are Buddhist. And I went to even to Italy, small mountain, there are Buddhists, and in France, and there are many people who are find out the compassion and the wisdom in the Buddhist or in other religion. More and more people are coming to believe that we do have a hope. And at the same time, and I just see, or every day we open the newspaper, and there are so many disasters and much more, not nature disaster, because we are paying the price, but we are not taking care of our planet. But other disaster, killing peoples and everywhere, and I don't understand. I'm very, very happy mother with two children and have nice husband, but I just feel like I need to do something, organize the column to China, to France, but just feel like so limited and, you know, like even you don't want to open the newspaper anymore, it's hard to balance. I just want you to maybe give me some
inspiration. Yeah. And certainly there's lots of problems in the world, because that's got what gets reported in the newspapers. But when there are solutions to problems, they just fall away from the newspapers. People don't see those solutions. Certainly because I grew up in England, and I studied the history, which was European history. Do you know how many centuries that countries like England and France and Germany and Spain have been fighting? There was one war called the Hundred Years' War, you know, between England and Spain. And now it's impossible to imagine a war between those countries. There's something which has happened, you know, in Europe, you know, the European Union, where basically, because of the movement of people, the intermarriages, the common culture, or the relating to our common cultures, that war is not a possibility anymore. And I find that is a wonderful example of maybe how we can even move further, not just from a European Union, an Asian Union, a world union, where all of our fights are just on the soccer field, and not sort of on the battlefield. And the reason that happens, you know, is because the people in Europe, there's different parts of their culture, there's something in common which they've embraced. And that commonality is what can bind us together. If I look at you and you look at me, you're a woman, you know, you're young, I'm a man, I'm old, you're lay, I'm a monk. And that's a separation between us. But if I look what we have in common, then that's what can bind us together. So it's a way of changing the way we look at each other, even our religions. We look at what the differences we have between our religions, and they're really quite clear. We can look what we have in common, then that's what can bind us together. And I think that's what we need to do much more, not to look at the differences, but to look at what we share. And I think that's the message which I got from what happened in Europe, and the way that there's no wars possible in that area of the world anymore, or in Western Europe. Maybe that might happen in other places as well, especially the religious wars which we have. And of course, one obvious solution which I've been promoting even to education ministers isn't it about time we stop religious schools? Because one of the biggest problems in places like the West, when you have a religious school, like a Christian school, they only take Christians, they just teach Christians, and then they go to Christian university, and that's all they know about life. Especially Islamic schools. Go to an Islamic school, you just hang out with fellow Muslims, you marry a Muslim, you go to a Muslim university, you work with a Muslim company. That's all you know. And it's called segregation of society. If a country like Australia would have the guts to ban all religious schools, and just have secular schools, maybe in a Sunday school you can have religion taught, or maybe one lesson a week or two lessons a week, you know, you can invite the imam or the monk or the priest in to give the talk. But if you grew up in the same soccer team, a Muslim and a Buddhist and a Hindu and a Christian, if they're your friends, how on earth can we hate our friends and have wars with them? One of the biggest problems, I think, in our world is the segregation of society according to wealth and according to religion, according to caste and class sometimes. And that's something a government has the power. Of course, it is social engineering, but it's a positive social engineering. If you grow up with different people, you accept them and love them and respect them for the rest of your life. If you segregate people from the early on, we live in a segregated world. It's a simple solution. And for anyone who starts to say, what about religious freedom? I argued this with the health minister in Singapore 3 nights ago. I said, look, what you're talking about is not religious freedom. It's religious indoctrination, religious subjugation. It's not freedom at all. Real freedom, religious freedom, would allow, say, a Muslim to marry a Buddhist. If that's what you want to do, you're free to do that. The French government in 2001 enacted a law which limits religions. Any religion or religious practices which clearly infringe upon basic human rights and human freedoms is illegal. So basic human rights and human freedoms take precedence over any religious practice. Now that's called religious freedom. So I think one of the things we can do is to take back the meaning of the word religious freedom. It's been hijacked and it's been used as a cover for bad religious practices in all religions, which actually subjugate, intimidate and hurt human beings. So when we take back the word religious freedom and understand what it truly means, which is the freedom to choose your religion, to practice it the way you feel appropriate, or to choose no religion, and to not force it on any other human being. Then that religious freedom is something which I can say sadhu, sadhu, sadhu to. I think the Buddha would say sadhu to. Sadhu means yes, good, wonderful. And I think it's something which would help solve some of those religious-born problems in our world. Let's have freedom of religion. Not in the way that most people say it, but the freedom to choose, not subjugate. How old do you have to be to vote in Thailand? 18. Why can't people vote in Thailand at 16? Why can't they vote at 16 or 14 or 10? You know why? Because we don't think they're knowledgeable, intelligent or mature enough to choose a political party. So why on earth do we think that someone can choose a religion at the age of 10? Are they mature enough, intelligent enough to choose a religion at that age? Good question. If they can choose a religion at 10, they should be allowed to vote at 10. Can we say our children, I don't know, I might get into trouble here, to say that no, our child, our 10-year-old boy, he's a member of the PPP party, or he's a member of Chart Thai. They can't, you can't say that, can you? So why can you say, my child's a Buddhist, a Catholic, a Muslim? Now, the whole point of being a monk and teaching Dharma is not to tell you what you already know, but to get you to think. There's an old saying in the West, when everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. When everyone thinks the same, no one thinks at all. And actually, I can see some people going, I've gone over time, so I do apologize. Maybe we should wrap up now, a quarter of an hour over time. And I said earlier on, that company which banned overtime, so I'll be a hypocrite if I go on overtime now. So, last question. Yeah, okay.
Just one last question. How come a Buddhist country like Thailand, Vietnam, Burmese, like with people making a lot of merit and good karma, is not so developed like a country like UK, US, in terms of business?
Okay, first of all, a country is not Buddhist. People are Buddhist, not a country. So it's the people which make the country, not the country which makes the people. So it's the people, first of all. And again, now there are Buddhists, really good Buddhists, there are stupid Buddhists. There's all sorts of Buddhists in between. And sometimes develop. And sometimes, you know, you go to a place like England. Yeah, maybe have bigger houses, maybe get more money. But I think it's still the case that Thai people smile more. So again, we should not measure a country's status by its economy. Okay, it may be developed in one area, but underdeveloped in another area. And that's why we should start, you know, measuring a country's well-being, not just by... the economy is only one factor. Look at the suicide rates, you know, the harmony in families, social problems like longevity, ability to access a doctor, how we treat our old people, you know, how we treat sort of sick people. And those are sort of measures of a society's well-being, not just the size of their pay packets. So if we take those other factors into consideration, maybe we might be quite surprised. Maybe Thailand might be above England or the United States. Now, the last time I went to the United States, I was really shocked going through Seattle, seeing so many people sleeping on the streets. And I was actually surprised. And I asked the drivers, said, are these, haven't they got a job? I thought the economy was going well. I said, no, these have got jobs. But they're not making enough money to afford even the rent for an apartment. It's called working poor. Because the wage levels in the United States are so low now that even if a pair of you are getting a job, it's really hard to afford a house. Which is why they've got full-time jobs and they have to sleep on the street. Now, there's something very, very, very wrong with a country like that. The house prices, apartment prices are so expensive that people can't afford to work, can't afford to live in a house. So they live on the street. Fortunately, that doesn't happen in Bangkok. Because everybody's got an auntie, an uncle or someone. Your family structure is to be envied. There's always some place you can stay. And if you can't stay with your uncle or auntie or grandparent, you can always stay in what? In a monastery. We'll always take you in. So that's a wonderful structure you've got over here. So next time, if you ever go to a place like San Francisco, LA is obviously the same. You see people who've got no home. And you'd be surprised that they're working full-time jobs. And that's tragic when I heard that. Anyway, so thank you for that question. Do you want to sum up and finish off? Okay, do you want to sum up and finish off?
I would like to invite all of us to say Sathu three times as a means of appreciating the Dhamma talk by Prajan Pram. Sathu, sathu, sathu.
That was one of the worst three sadhus I've ever heard. Come put some energy into it. Come on. One, Sadhu.
Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.
See, it's much more fun doing it that way, isn't it?